From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. For some people, hair is a serious business.
Well, you have bad hair.
What did you say?
I said your hair looks stupid.
No! Today we'll find out what chemicals are actually in the products that we use on our hair and skin. First, though, we talked earlier this week about why Augusta, Georgia was recently named one of the least healthy cities in the country. That comes from research from the personal finance site WalletHub. Kelsey Budge is a personal trainer in Augusta, and she said the low health ranking matches her experience there.
They only offer one farmer's market, and it's closed during the winter. And unfortunately, Whole Foods just closed down. The only restaurants that you can go to that are healthy are really downtown, and there's only a handful of them. Everything else that line the streets are fast food restaurants. Fitness centers as well, I feel, are lacking a little bit.
Here are your first thoughts. Phil Wall called us from Augusta. He disagrees with Kelsey.
I would love to give her an introduction to our Canal Trail, which comes all the way from downtown Augusta. A great place to call a green space, I would say. So there's much more to offer. Organic foods are available at fresh markets. At the Earth Fair market, her comment about Whole Foods, unfortunately, was not the correct perspective for Augusta.
KW Oxnard tweets, Boulder makes exercising easy and cheap. Dedicated bike, walk, skate paths, community rec centers, climbing walls, public transit, etc. And Vince Aragon tweets, wife and I just completed Whole30 diet. We did well, but if we didn't have the means, it would have been unaffordable. We always love to hear what you think. You can call us like Phil did at 404-500-9457 or tweet us. We are at OST Talk, and remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Tom Price's 6th District congressional seat is empty now that Price is the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services. That seat has been solidly Republican for a very long time, but there's a chance it could go to a Democrat this time around during the special election on April 18th. With us to talk about the race is Greg Bluestein. He's a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to have you. And also with us is Audrey Haynes, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia. Hi, Audrey.
Good morning.
So this is what's called a jungle primary. What does that mean? I mean, it has nothing to do with the humidity or the wildlife, but what is a jungle primary?
Well, it means all 18 candidates, that's 11 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 2 independents, are all on the same April 18th ballot. And it means regardless of party, and the top 2 vote-getters, if no one gets 50% plus 1 of the vote, end up on a June 20th runoff. So that makes the political calculus very complicated for all the Republicans and Democrats and independents in the race who all are competing against each other and the other party at the same time.
So, Audrey, tell us a little bit about this seat, about the 6th District, with strong roots in the Republican Party going back to Newt Gingrich. Tell us about this district.
Yeah, so in 1979, we saw the end of Democrats in that district, and Newt won. He had been pursuing that district for a while. And then afterwards, you saw basically Republicans really dominate from that time period. You had Johnny Isaacson, and Tom Price has, you know, just had a very comfortable time in the 6th District. It's a well-to-do district. It is an educated district. There's a lot of business orientation in there. And Tom Price himself is a very conservative Republican, and he has managed to win there handily over a long period of time.
And yet, Greg, you've written that this special election could be a litmus test for Trump support. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, as Professor Haynes said, Tom Price won this district with 60+% of the vote just about every time he went up for re-election. But Donald Trump only won it by 1 point. And this is a district that Mitt Romney carried 5 years ago with double digits. So this was an area that Marco Rubio won in Georgia's March presidential primary. And John Ossoff supporters and other Democrats think that it could be fertile ground for sort of a Trump backlash in April.
So let's take a listen to an attack ad against Ossoff, because we'll be talking about him in a moment. Ossoff went to Georgetown University when he was there. He appeared in a video campaign against the school's alcohol policy, and they have been playing bits of that video campaign Ossoff filmed. Here's a bit of it.
I'm Han Solo, captain of the Millennium Falcon. She's the baby ran four kegs by Dops and her three parsecs.
So not a terrible Chewbacca impression, but here's a little bit more from that attack ad.
John Ossoff, not honest, not serious, not ready. Sorry, Johnny, but the truth strikes back.
That's an attack ad funded by the Congressional Leadership Fund. Audrey, people are wondering if this kind of thing that tries to paint Ossoff as a sort of an elitely educated outsider or liberal will work or won't it? What do the voters think, or what are their priorities, I guess?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And it's hard to tell. I actually tried to get some data from the 6th District on some newer trends and some newer survey data, but there wasn't a lot there. So painting him as an elitist, well, it's a very educated district. Most of the people who live in the 6th District and work there are professionals. They've gone to college. A lot of them have postdoc degrees. It's highly tech-oriented. In fact, some of the Republicans who are running recognize that, and that's a part of their background. I don't think it's going to have much of an effect, except generally maybe a positive one, because the one thing that Ossoff really has going for him is he's in the lead. This is generating more momentum. He has a lot of outside support from outside the state. He has the full backing of a lot of different groups. And, you know, for him, it probably did more to help him than it did to hurt him, because by targeting him, they sort of put him, you know, in the spotlight. And that is a real benefit.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Audrey Haynes, a University of Georgia political science professor, and also Greg Bluestein from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We're talking about the race to replace Tom Price in the 6th Congressional District of Georgia. And when you say he has outside support, there was even a wine shop in Portland holding a fundraiser for Ossoff, with offering a southern feast for $60 a plate. And this is the thing that has kind of made a lot of headlines, Greg, is the amount of money Ossoff have been able to collect. The website Daily Costs raised more than $1 million for him. Why?
Yeah, and also I'll say that John Ossoff is going to be in Washington today, and he has a fundraiser with Nancy Pelosi and other top House leaders. The party has rallied around him, and the amount of money he claims to have raised, and we can't verify it yet, but he claims to raise more than $3 million is just astounding in the opening months. And he announced in January, and it's the Ides of March, and he's already raised more than $3 million for a special election that's usually seen as a shoe-in for Republicans. And that has really galvanized a lot of attention behind his campaign. I'd also add, too, that other Republicans, candidates even, are marveling at his ground game. I mean, I live in the 6th, and his canvassers have visited my district now twice, my neighborhood now twice. So there's just a lot of also distraction and fractured on the Republican side, because you've got candidates who are cozying up to Donald Trump, saying that they're the number one 100% supporters of Trump, and others who are barely mentioning his name. So it's kind of a skewed field on the Republican side, and there's so many high-profile names on the Republican side, there's no one to rally around on that side yet.
And that's what makes it this race so interesting. Audrey, let me go to you, because Ossoff's I guess rallying cry is "Make Trump Furious." Could that play in this district that very narrowly went for Trump in the election?
Well, you know what? I think he has to be very careful, because a special election like this, there's a large element of mobilization. So, you know, the good thing is it is getting national attention, so many more people are going to know, and there's going to be more turnout. On the Democratic side, I've never seen quite so much organization. I mean, you had a lot of support for Barack Obama in 2008, and there was a novelty and great themes, but, I mean, there is so much. It's almost as if the Democratic Party woke up and said, oh, my God, if we don't do something, we're in trouble, and they're really acting on it. So, you know, he really has to play on that. But at the same time, if there are any voters, for example, some of those turnout voters, they turned out in 2012 for a Democratic candidate, but they didn't turn out in 2016. He's got to focus on them. Non-college women, that's one area of group that tends not to like Trump, but they have to be mobilized too. He's got a lot of younger people. I mean, one benefit to this district is there are a ton of young people under the age of 44, and that may help him. But he may want to be like Rob Portman and talk about issues that matter to the people in that district, because it is a congressional race. And, you know, sometimes national politics plays a role, and it may in this case, but very often congressional races are a little different. What Greg was saying, and Greg's done a great job covering this race, I've been reading all of his pieces, you know, Ossoff is doing the ground game. He's got help from the Democratic Party. I know the people like Rebecca DeHart in Atlanta, they are working really hard for him. So he has a chance, but you know, the district is not biased toward him.
Yeah, okay. So, Greg, let me put this to you then. If, and this is a big if, because we know from very recent past experience that polls can't always tell us a whole story, if John Ossoff wins this seat, what does that mean for the Democrats? They seem to think it means a sort of a real symbolic victory against the Republican Party and Donald Trump. Are they right? Greg?
I'll preface this by saying that Republicans are still supremely confident they'll take the seat, and they think that in a runoff, that his advantages will be neutralized, because runoffs tend to be an older electorate that's more conservative. But John Ossoff I think it's safe to say he's going for the knockout punch. It's an outside shot, but he's going to go for the...
Meaning he's trying to get 51% or more.
Yep, 50% plus one in April. And there are some Republican campaigns that are beginning to get worried about that. Because if Ossoff wins, it will be a national statement. This is the most competitive and one of the first special elections since Trump's victory. So it would say a lot, and that's why it's become a national story. That's why Washington Post, New York Times have all put this race on their front pages, and it's been all over the airwaves, because this is sort of a symbolic moment in the post-Trump era.
So, and can I
go ahead, Audrey?
If he does win. And, you know, there's a slim chance that may happen. It will be a rallying cry, and a lot of elected members of Congress will be paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that's a warning shot.
Yes, that, you know, maybe doing everything that you're doing right now is not the best idea. Because, you know, we have had sort of a shift, we've had so much change, we could talk about it in terms of the parties for a long time, but we've seen somewhat of a flip in the two parties. And if Trump can't deliver to those working class voters that he, you know, has brought in and pulled over from the Democratic Party, that's a big question. You know, I would say that 2018 is going to be very interesting. If we win now, if the Democratic Party wins now, that's amazing. But in 2018, so much more will have happened, and there'll be so much more fodder, so much reality that has been produced, that we're going to see voters making some really tough decisions, I think.
That is UGA Professor Audrey Haynes and also AJC reporter Greg Bluestein talking about the race to replace Tom Price in the 6th Congressional District. Greg and Audrey, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Celeste.
Just ahead, the unknown history of black beauty cosmetics. First, though, the algorithm that law enforcement has developed to track serial killers. This is on Second Thought. It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Unsolved murders can become cold cases and then fall off the radar screens of local detectives. And that's where the Murder Accountability Project comes in. The group sifts through large amounts of homicide data to find crime patterns and predict possible outcomes. Tom Hargrove started that project, and he joins me on the line from Virginia. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Celeste. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you as well. And with us as well is the project's co-director, Mike Arntfield. He's a criminology professor at Western University in Ontario, Canada, and his students are now studying murder data that was collected in the Atlanta metro area. Mike joins us by Skype. Hi, Mike.
Morning, Celeste. How are you?
it's good to have you as well. So Tom, we really want to talk about the solve rate. But in order to talk about that, we need to talk first about your algorithm. Tell us how you developed this algorithm, which is a new one in law enforcement.
Yeah, we were aware for many years of the challenge that police face in identifying serial killings. Linkage blindness, pattern blindness, it's been called a few things. But it's very hard for case-based investigators to link cases that have similar attributes because a homicide detective is assigned to a case and another homicide detective is assigned to another case. If they share information, there's a chance the linkage will be made, but if not, they don't. So we developed an algorithm to try to overcome that problem, which takes FBI computer files and turns, we have records now on more than 700,000 murders in the United States, and the algorithm turns that into about 10,000 groups. We group according to the geography of the killing, the gender of the victim, the age group of the victim, and the weapon used to kill the victim. Those four variables are grouping variables. And then we tell the computer to look at those 10,000 groups and identify those groups that had an extremely low rate of solution. Experience tells us that often a very, very low rate of solution occurs because there are common killers who so far have not been apprehended. Atlanta's strangulation victims are sending a red alert to our algorithm and have for many years. The Atlanta strangulations, especially the female strangulations, are one of the largest clusters of suspicious murders in the nation.
So this may be the first time that people here are hearing about the Atlanta strangulation murders. Mike, can you give us more information about that?
So what we're looking at is, as Tom mentioned, these large clusters of, if you go to our site at murderdata.org, you'll see that we identify unsolved murders in red. So there's a visual representation of the data there that will really sort of, again, if people haven't seen this before or heard about this, really sort of jar them, I think, when they see it. And what we're looking at, in particular, my cold case initiative at the university, is from 1985 to 2000. I mean, there is a much larger set of victims than that, but in sort of delineating the victim pool to between 85 and 2000, we've got 72 females who have been strangled and where those cases are also unsolved. So as Tom mentioned, large clusters of unsolved, but then in addition to that, strangulation as a cause of death, those are two very good discriminators to suggest that we're dealing with a serial offender targeting strangers or stranger-on-stranger attacks, which are statistically rare, which is when you see large spikes like this in a metropolitan statistical area, is, again, cause for major concern.
So, Tom, one of the things that your data has sort of called to my mind is this dip in the solve rates. So in the 1960s, the solve rate on murders, homicides, was almost 90%. And I'm looking at the statistics right now. As of 2015, it's just above 60%. And yet we have so much more technology at our disposal at this point. And, you know, enough people have watched all those CSI TV shows to believe that, you know, you can solve a murder based on a flake of skin at a murder site. So why do you think the solve rate has gone down so far?
Yeah, unfortunately, if you get your opinions about homicide investigations from television, you think all murders are solved in 60 minutes by beautiful people in squad rooms surrounded by gorgeous color monitors.
Right.
It just isn't that way. Increasingly, police departments are squeezed financially. We have insufficient resources applied to the problem of murder. There are just not enough trained homicide detectives going after the bad guys. That's probably the primary problem. Also, we like to say that it's a failure of will by local political leaders to make major crimes a priority. Mayors and city councils face increasing competition for every limited dollar they have, and so they have made a decision that often means there aren't enough homicide detectives working the cases, and that's exactly what's gone on over time.
So we spoke with Adam Lee III. He's the major crimes commander with the Atlanta Police Department, works with the homicide unit. He says the APD actually forwarded two of its cases to the Murder Accountability Project recently. Here's what he says.
We feel that for some reason, with quite a few of our homicides, people know, but they just don't tell for whatever reason. I mean, you would think that offering large amounts of reward money would get people to talk, but that doesn't always work.
Mike, you were a detective in Canada for some time. How big a problem is it that people don't give the police the information they need to solve murders?
Well, that's a major contributing factor. And I mean, aside from, as Tom mentioned, the will to devote proper financial and human resources to this problem, we can also see in Canada really where I will say there is not necessarily in most cases as progressive a policy in terms of engaging the media and engaging the public. We see that agencies that routinely bury information are very circumspect in press briefings in terms of sharing information and don't solicit public input have a much higher unsolved rate than those who, you know, whether it's a few weeks later or a few years later, come back to cases and begin to sort of parsimoniously release bits of evidence with a view to, again, sort of tweaking public interest and in keeping cases alive. So between what's gone on in Atlanta and I would say the larger problem, and especially as we see in Canada, is that the public can only, you cannot solve these cases without some degree of public input. And that's in large part why we exist and why the Murder Accountability Project does not keep secrets. We essentially crowdsource and make this data available to the public with the hopes that, you know, people will of their own volition see what's going on in their backyard or find a record on there that they know something about and then maybe come forward.
I'm speaking with Mike Arntfield of Western University. He teaches criminology there, and Tom Hargrove of the Murder Accountability Project. The project relies on homicide data nationwide to find trends in murders. And let's hear another comment from Adam Lee of the Atlanta Police Department. He's talking about being able to solve homicides because of new DNA technology.
Just about everything contains DNA these days. Anything you touch, now that we have the touch DNA technology, it's not just bodily fluids anymore. It's anything that any surface that suspect or a person may have touched near or in the crime scene helps us solve cases now.
And yet, Mike, there are limitations to DNA evidence. Obviously, if somebody is not in the database, you're not going to be able to get a match. So how does you have your students sifting through data? What data are they looking at?
What we're looking at, so this is going to be a multi-tiered operation. I mean, it's been years since these cases have been looked at substantively, so we're not going to solve this overnight. But the first thing we're doing is assigning victims to these names. So of those 72, and again, I should stress these are not all APD cases. These are, you know, metropolitan statistical area cases. So there are some neighboring sheriff's departments that own these records and are still investigating these cases. But from Atlanta PD, we have received a vetted list of now 33 names. Again, we've received more names than that, but we have limited the names to 33 of female victims of a certain demographic and age group that we feel may be able to be linked. And what we're doing now is we're going through and we're trying to figure out the life stories of these women through various software programs, through soliciting media input and public input. And the idea is that we can assign some kind of biographical narrative and find out who these women were. What were they doing for a living? Where did they live? Did they have substance abuse issues? Did they have strong family connections? Did they have police records? The idea being that if we can begin to, and this is a process generally known as victimology, so studying crimes through sort of the life of the victims. And what we're hoping to do is to begin to identify then larger linkages between certain victim types. I mean, all we have through the FBI data is the ethnicity and the age and the gender. So we need more than that to be able to definitively link these victims. That starts with the names. And I will say that Atlanta Police records, the people working there have been remarkably helpful in finding what in many cases are names and investigations that have no digital record. They've gone and had to find the original actual hard copy analog murder book, as we call it, that's been stored away for, you know, 20 years now.
So in a way, Tom, your algorithm adds a completely different tool for law enforcement. And I say that because even Adam Lee of the APD says that, especially in recent years, sometimes the solution of a case comes down to chance. Here he is talking about cameras.
You know, people have cameras at their homes, businesses have cameras, you know, the cities, streets have cameras. So there was a time there just last year where we had like three homicides in a row that were actually on video, the whole incident, because they were in the area where someone happened to have a camera.
So that's kind of the opposite of what your algorithm does, Tom. And yet it's been successful in the past at identifying places where possible serial killers may be operating. Why? How is your algorithm successful at that?
Because it identifies locations that have had an astonishingly low rate of solution, suspiciously low. And when you go back and go case by case, if you put a narrative and a name to the victims, which is exactly what Mike's group is doing, you then start to see a pretty clear pattern that that these narratives are astonishingly similar. When that happens, something's going on, and quite often it's because there's a common killer in many of the cases.
And yet you start
the only problem with the algorithm is that there's a delay. It takes a year, up to 2 years, to get data back from the FBI. This is hardly live-time, real-time reporting. And so, by definition, by the time we're warning the public that there is a cluster that has a high probability of containing serial killings, they're already cold cases, which is exactly what we're looking at in the very large cluster of strangulations in Atlanta.
And yet you started this as a journalism major, did you not? That's where the roots of this algorithm come from? You started it as a way to report on crime.
Yeah, this was started as a project when I was a national correspondent for the former Scripps Howard News Service. It no longer exists. But this was an attempt to study unsolved murder and then to see if it was possible to identify serial killings among the unsolved murders. At that time, we did this in 2010, there were 185,000 unsolved murders in the United States committed since 1980. Today, there are over 222,000 unsolved murders, and so there are quite a few murders
wow.
to cull through.
So, Mike, what, from your experience both in teaching criminology and working as a detective, what could you have used the most? I mean, Tom is saying that there's a real lag time in between getting this data and actually putting it to use. So what else could you have used that might have brought your solve rate up or that of your department?
Well, obviously, timely access to the data is important. But quite frankly, what I would have liked to have had, and I think what every detective would like to have in their toolbox, is precisely what our site does, which is bridges those sort of interjurisdictional blind spots between agencies. So again, if you go to Atlanta, it's the Metropolitan Statistical Region. So you have their murder records reflecting several different police agencies that otherwise don't have a common records management system or database, or don't necessarily have a, you know, CompStat meeting where they're all at the table at the same time, or don't compare notes. And what it is for the first time ever, and this was conceived years ago in the U.S. as VICAP and in Canada as VICLASS, both of which are really failed sort of initiatives. What you have is the consolidation of years' worth of records all at one time, all in one place, that allows you to confirm hunches, that allows you to tinker with different search parameters and follow your intuition that, you know, if you see a case and it has, you know, sort of that all the indicators of a serial murder, or it's clearly a stranger on stranger attack, there are sexual elements, there are paraphilic or posing components, that you can then search in real time for recent cases in neighboring jurisdictions. And there was really no way to do that so easily before now. Again, VICAP, the database,
I want to make sure we say the violent is VICAP is the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, that's part of the FBI and is a federal program. Go ahead, keep going.
Right. So VICAP, Violent Criminal Apprehension Program in the U.S., and in Canada, the Violent Crime Linkage Analysis System, which are both very similar and rely on input provided by a questionnaire completed by lead detectives in homicide cases. In the U.S., it was a voluntary initiative with very low compliance. In Canada, it's mandatory, but the quality of the data is extraordinarily poor, and it might as well be not mandatory. So what we have is a vetted version of that that we have essentially built and is available not only to law enforcement but to the public, which, to go back to your question earlier on, are often the best resource the police can rely on to help solve a case.
We only have 30 seconds left. Tom, what's been your response? The APD has been pretty cooperative, it sounds like, but what about on average? Is law enforcement responsive to you?
Oh, wonderfully so. We attend as many gatherings of homicide detectives as we can around the country, and they literally line up to shake our hands and thank us for what we're doing. It is breathtaking how few resources homicide detectives have. There really should be a national list of unsolved murders.
Yeah.
We're building one, but
slowly,
there is
yeah.
no government doing that.
That's Tom Hargrove of the Murder Accountability Project and Western University Criminology Professor Mike Artfield. That project is, you can get more information about it at gpbnews.org. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, we'll talk about some of the dangers of a cosmetic and hair products. This is On Second Thought.
What's that on your hair?
I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. I hope you join us tomorrow. We'll talk about a new children's book that tells the story of the desegregation of a Georgia elementary school in the 1950s. And we wondered, how do you talk to your kids about the civil rights era, or do you? How do you teach them about the fight for equality in the United States? Call and leave us a message at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us tomorrow for that conversation. When you go into the hair salon or a cosmetic store, how much do you know about the products that are used on your skin or your hair? A new study says there are dangerous chemicals in some of these products, particularly those marketed to Black women. That study comes from the nonprofit Environmental Working Group, and here to talk more about it is the group's Deputy Director of Research, Nika Leiba. She joins us by Skype. Hi, Nika.
Hi.
Also with us is Alelia Bundles. She's a self-proclaimed Black hair historian, and she is also the great-great-granddaughter of Madam C.J. Walker, who was the first Black millionaireess in America and invented the world's first hair straightening formula. Alelia, thanks for joining us.
Hi, but we'll talk about, she didn't invent the hair straightening formula, but we'll talk about that.
We will get right to that in a moment, but first I want to welcome in studio, we have Atlanta hairstylist Latasha Gray. It's good to have you as well.
Thanks. Good morning.
So she did not invent it, because she is credited with that, Alelia.
Well, you know what? There's a lot of stuff on the internet that's not correct. She did not invent the straightening comb. She did not invent the perm. She invented a hair conditioner that healed scalp disease.
And she was certainly successful at marketing all those things, whether she invented them or not.
Well, she did not. She did not market a straightener, but she marketed a shampoo and Madam Walker's wonderful hair grower and other ointments that that healed scalp disease.
Okay, and it's important. I want to make sure everyone's aware, staying with me, on why this is important. Why do you make a point of saying that she did not market the hair straightening formula?
Well, because her initial problem is that she was going bald. She had really bad dandruff and scalp infections 111 years ago, when most people didn't have indoor plumbing. Hygiene was very different. People didn't wash their hair very often, and so they had really bad scalp disease. So her revolutionary system was a shampoo and an ointment that contained sulfur, something like Vaseline, that healed the dandruff and the sores on the scalp so the hair could grow. Hence, Madam Walker's wonderful hair grower.
Okay, so this subject obviously has been a subject of debate, certainly among Black women for sure, for a very, very long time. How much, Latasha, do your clients ask you about, or how concerned are they over the chemicals that are in the products that are used in their hair?
I would say 3 out of 5 clients come in, and when they're trying to get their hair shampooed, they always ask, is this sulfate-free? That's really the only thing that they have a precaution about. Is it sulfate-free?
And how hard is it to find products that don't have sulfates in them?
It's not really hard. Our salon in particular offers 1 or 2 lines that that are sulfate-free, but we do definitely offer ones that do have sulfate in it. So in my opinion, when you go to the store, there are a decent amount of options for sulfate-free products.
Okay, and that brings us to you, Nika, because the research coming out of the Environmental Working Group suggests that it can be difficult to find products that don't have chemicals that can be toxic. Can you tell me the results of your research?
Yes, yeah, certainly. EWG has been working on cosmetics and personal care products and looking at their toxicity for years. And we know how antiquated the law is that governs personal care, meaning that companies can use almost any ingredient that they see fit in products without testing them for safety. But we wanted to look specifically at products marketed to Black women. And that report showed that of the more than 1,000 products we looked at, unfortunately, Black women who shop exclusively for products marketed to their demographic would have fewer healthier options of products to choose from.
Now, this isn't a result of your research, but did you have any idea why that is? Why are there so many more potentially toxic chemicals in products marketed to Black women?
You know, it would be speculation. I can speculate that there are some traditional hair products that the Black community uses that have caustic ingredients like hair straighteners and some hair dyes that have hormone-disrupting chemicals. But again, we didn't look specifically at that, so it would be speculation.
Well, then let me take that to our Black hair historian, Alelia Bundles. Why do you think it has ended up this way, where there are so many potentially dangerous chemicals in products for Black women?
Well, you know, when I looked at the research, I looked at the analysis, it looks as if of the almost 1,200 products that were analyzed, hair relaxers and hair dyes and hair bleaches were included in that. And everything really sort of skews in that direction. Those are the worst offenders. It is significant that the share of the hair care market for relaxers has really gone down within the last decade. And I think that's a result of people being more conscious of it. But I would say, you know, when you look at the hair relaxers and you look at why women feel they need to straighten their hair, there is so much societal pressure and cultural pressure to do that. The Army finally lifted its ban on locks and braids. People are still being fired from their jobs if they don't straighten their hair. And so there is that kind of cultural pressure that makes people feel as if they need to use those chemical relaxers.
The documentary Good Hair from comedian Chris Rock goes into a lot of these issues that we're discussing right now. In it, a chemist is telling Chris here about the dangers of a chemical that's used in a particular relaxer.
If it gets down into the scalp, it'll kill it at the root and you'll actually have bald spots there.
So if you're a beautician or something and you deal in sodium hydroxide all day, I mean...
I wouldn't do it. If you breathe just the fumes from sodium hydroxide, those fumes will ruin your lungs. They'll damage your lungs permanently.
Latasha, how long have you been in this business?
I've been doing hair since 2007, but full-time since 2015 at a hair salon.
Have you been exposed to some chemicals that gave you concern?
No. Actually, the hair salon I work at is a natural hair salon. That means that we do not apply relaxers. However, we do apply hair color, but not relaxer. So I feel like as a hairstylist, I have a reduced exposure.
You're not being exposed to sodium hydroxide, which is caustic.
Right.
But let's then explain what natural hair is for people who may not be of African American descent and have no idea what that is.
Right. So it's so funny. It's a two-way street. So natural sometimes can mean when you don't have a relaxer in your hair or when you're chemical free. But there are some individuals that do not put a relaxer in their hair, but they have hair color. So technically, you're not chemical free. You're not natural. But natural just means that you don't put chemicals in your hair to alter your hair texture. But like I said, most people are, it's very rare for me to see a client that is completely natural, because even if they don't use a relaxer, they're using hair color.
We're talking about the dangers of certain cosmetic products, especially those targeted to black women. And I'm speaking with Atlanta hairstylist Latasha Gray, you just heard. Also, Niga Liba of the Environmental Working Group and journalist, and black hair historian Alelia Bundles. Nika, this particular research is not being duplicated. In fact, it's not all that easy to find this information on what is in hair products. Why? Why is it so difficult in some cases to find out what's going on to our hair and our skin?
You know, that's a great question. And groups like Black Women for Wellness and the West Harlem Environmental Action have done a little bit of, have done some work on this issue, but it is not widely studied. I think part of the reason is because there's not a desire. You know, the consumer doesn't know yet that she needs to know this information. And so getting this information to them right now will make them more appreciative of the dangers and therefore demand more information about it. So we're hoping that this spurs more research on the topic.
Alelia, have you seen, through Black hair history, have you seen a change in the trend in terms of people's awareness of what's in these products, and also what Latasha was talking about in terms of the push for natural hair?
Yes. I mean, I'm old enough to have gone through the original hair wars in the early 60s when we went from pressed hair and perms to natural hair, and I've watched the pendulum swing back and forth. It is very interesting, really, in this last sort of 5 to 7 years, where there are companies like Sundial Brands and Shea Moisture and others, black-owned companies in particular, where they are scoring well on this EWG study, with fewer high-hazard, more low-hazard ingredients. And I think they're very aware of offering products that are useful for African-American women who have quite a few different textures of hair. We range from kinky to straight. And to have products that don't have parabens, that don't have sulfates, this is something that's very important to the consumer. But I do agree that this study is really needed to raise awareness, because I think most people don't think about it. Even if they've gone from the sodium hydroxide in the relaxers, there are still plenty of other things that are not healthy.
So, Latasha, how have you seen this trend play out in terms of what customers ask for when they come into your salon?
Okay, well, I know you've heard of YouTube, right?
No, so, what is that?
So, consumers, it's so funny. They watch YouTube, and then sometimes they come in the salon and they tell us, hey, what are you doing? Because I saw on YouTube that you're supposed to be doing this to my hair, or you're supposed to use this on my hair. So, like I said, I think bloggers and natural hair enthusiasts that have created YouTube channels because they may have done research or whatever, they do expose clients to, hey, use this product, don't use this product. Don't use sulfate. Let's co-wash. Don't shampoo your hair often. Like, they have these different strategies.
What is co-wash?
Co-wash is basically when you're not using shampoo to cleanse your hair. You're actually using conditioner to cleanse your hair.
Because shampoo can strip off the oils that protect your hair.
Right. And as a stylist, our job is to get the hair to look the way the client wants it to look. They have a desired style in mind. And sometimes using certain products can prevent that from happening. So some of the products that may not have sulfate, or the concept of not using things that don't have chemical or highly hazardous things, sometimes those products can help you reach your goal for styling, and sometimes it prevents you from reaching.
But wait, have you had clients then come in who have damaged their hair with these products irreversibly?
Yes. Yes.
So let me go back to the research of the Environmental Working Group then, Nika. What else needs to be known? Because frankly, some of the blogs that you watch is based on research that is, in my view, kind of sketchy. It's not necessarily good, solid clinical research. So what else needs to be done?
I think the consumer needs to become more educated about these ingredients. And that's something that all of us are starting to do now. And luckily, we have a resource like Skin Deep. But it's not just chemical hair straighteners that have ingredients ingredients of concern. There are parabens, which are endocrine disruptors and can potentially affect fertility. You know, there are allergens. They're all ingredients linked to cancer. So becoming more aware of these chemicals that are frequently used in products that we use every single day, and then demanding that companies reformulate or take those chemicals out. What we've seen over the last few years is that consumer pressure has forced the industry to change, move towards better ingredients. And so with more education and more awareness of this issue, we're hoping that that trend continues.
And is this a possibly a pendulum swing, Alelia, as you were referring to earlier? Could we be headed in the midst of a natural hair revolution at the moment, and then it'll swing back towards relaxers and straightening again?
I hope not. I hope it doesn't swing all the way back. I hope that we are, you know, we're now at a place where there's so many options for products that don't have these harmful ingredients, but that also do the trick. And there is pressure to, when people want a certain style and the hairstylist feels the pressure to conform to that. But there also are other ways. I mean, I know in our new Madam C.J. Walker Beauty Culture line, there are no silicones in our oils, but it still achieves the same result. And I think that there has to be consciousness raising. I mean, I'll just tell you quickly, I was speaking at a high school where there's a beauty course, and young women who were pregnant were using the chemical relaxers, and the teachers really tried to get them not to do that during a certain period of their pregnancy, and they just felt the pressure to want to be able to do that. But that's harmful. That's a consciousness raising. It's like getting people to stop smoking, that there are other ways that you can have other styles or achieve other looks without being harmful to yourself.
Latasha, this gets tricky, though. There are a lot of natural products. Even if you go into Walgreens now, these things that you never used to be able to find, mm-hmm. I can find my Cantu shampoo there and my mm-hmm. Miss Jessie's cream for after the shower. But this gets tricky because people are very emotional to their hair. It's not always just a logical proposition. I mean, how do you get through some of that when you're speaking to your clients?
Are you referencing...
People have emotional ties to products.
Right.
Then their hair becomes, it's not a logical thing anymore. That discussion about hair mm-hmm. can be very passionate.
Right.
How do you cut through that?
Honestly, when a person decides to come, I mean, you can either decide to go to a salon that's for natural hair, or you can just say, hey, that's a bunch of crock. I'm not buying what they're selling. Let me go to another salon, right? So a lot of the clients that I deal with, they have made a conscious decision that, hey, I want better for my hair. Now, even with that, like I said, I still do have clients that are very attached to certain brands. And what I, as a stylist, like to do is if they are attached to a certain brand, let's reduce the amount of usage. Keep using it sparingly, because me personally, I always feel like too much of anything isn't good for you. So I don't really try to snatch away, like, you know, what they're so used to. But I say, hey, you've been using this X amount of times, let's reduce it, and then hopefully wean them off of it. But you're right, you can't. It's very hard to get a woman to not be loyal to a brand. But the best way is to wean them off of it.
That is Atlanta hairstylist Latasha Gray. We also spoke with Nika Leiba of the Environmental Working Group and journalist and black hair historian Alelia Bundles. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, but we always love to know what you think. What kind of beauty products are you loyal to? Have you had a bad experience? Call and tell us at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. The show is at OSD Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.